it's Diane. On my mind, a son digs into his father's communist past. David Marinus has written biographies of Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, but his latest book tackles a more familiar subject, his own father. On March 12, 1952, in Detroit, Elliot Marinus was called to appear before the House Un-American Activities Committee, formed to investigate U.S. citizens suspected of having ties to communism during the Red Scare. Just a small child, David Marinus knew little about his father's communist past. His new book, A Good American Family, explores this family history and why this story has important lessons for the country today. David Marinus, how great to see you.
Oh, it's a delight to be with you, Diane.
Thank you. How did you begin to learn that somehow your mother and father were a bit different from everybody else?
My family always thought of itself as a little bit different, but not in that specific way of my parents having a past where they were members of the Communist Party USA. So that was a shadow of my life. I knew that at some point in the past, my father had been fired from a job and blacklisted, but he did not talk about it. And he had moved on so successfully by the time I became a conscious human being. And that was not what he ever taught me at all. He taught me to never fall for any rigid ideology and to search for the truth wherever it took me. And those were the great lessons of journalism that my newspaper man dad taught me. So this was deep in the background. And, you know, I've said that I've spent a lot of my career investigating the lives of people who were strangers to me when I started. Barack Obama, Vince Lombardi, Bill Clinton. And then over years of research and digging into their lives, they became familiar to me. And in this case, who could be more familiar to me than my father and mother? And yet I was a little concerned that by the end I would think they were strangers, that I didn't recognize them. That didn't happen. I came out of it with a deeper appreciation for them, for what they had endured, for this country in an odd way. You know, it was a dark period in American history,
oh,
the 1950s
boy.
And the Red Scare.
Boy.
And I consider my family lucky to have endured it.
Tell me how old you were when you consciously became aware that not only were your mother and father communists, but that the rest of the country viewed communism in this very negative way.
You know, there's a little scene in the book where my brother, who is 5 years older than me, right after my father was fired by the Detroit Times when he was named at a House Un-American Activities Committee hearing, my brother was at a friend's house, and the friend's mother said, you know, your family are communists.
Oh, wow.
It didn't happen to me, never. My brother didn't consider it a trauma, but he did live through that, almost with a sense of pride that we are different, I think. But for me, you know, sometime in the early 1980s, I was already a journalist, you know, deep into my career. We found the transcript of the hearings of HUAC when they came to Detroit.
The House Un-American Activities Committee.
And those transcripts were public record. It was the first time I read it, probably in 1983 or so.
But why did you go looking for it?
I did not at that point. My brother found it and then showed it to my sister and me. I didn't go looking for any of this until... See, my parents died, well, my father died in 2004, my mother 2006. They were both in their mid-80s and, you know, lived wonderful lives. But I knew I couldn't write this book when they were alive. Not that I couldn't, but I didn't want to. Because my father didn't talk about it. And I had tried once long ago, made a pathetic effort at writing a novel. I like to write novelistically, but using fact entirely. So anyway, I tried to interview my dad because I thought the novel might take place We lived in Iowa for a year as my father was recovering from the blacklist, and he worked for a strike paper before he got hired by the Capital Times in Madison, which was really our salvation. Anyway, I thought I would write a novel about that year in Iowa. I tried to interview my father about it. It went nowhere.
Nowhere.
He really didn't. I mean, he talked around it, but he didn't really get to the gist of it. And so I realized that was his choice. He had moved on. He had a wonderful career. He didn't want to be defined by that period. And so I wasn't going to write about it. But by 2015, after my parents were gone, I started to obsess about it.
Really?
Because I realized how important it was to our family's history. And here I had studied other people's family's history, but I hadn't really gone back to examine mine. And so there was an incredible moment early in my research where I went to the National Archives. They have all of the records of the House Un-American Activities Committee, and they had voluminous files on those hearings in Detroit. And when I opened up the box, the first file was Elliot Marinus, my father. I opened that and saw a 3-page statement. And in the transcript of the hearings, you hear my father saying, I would like to read a statement about what I think it means to be an American. And the chairman of the committee denied it. You know, if my father had sort of sought absolution for his sins and named names, they would have let him read it, but he did not.
I want to take you back to that date when your father received that subpoena from the HUAC in Detroit.
Yes.
And as soon as that subpoena arrived, he was fired.
He was fired that day. It was the same day that a FBI informant, a paid informant, a woman who had been hired by the FBI 9 years earlier to infiltrate the Communist Party in Michigan, Berenice Baldwin. She spent 9 years undercover, essentially, and became the secretary of the Michigan Communist Party and came in from the cold for those hearings. And really what HUAC was after was the United Auto Workers. They wanted to break up the communist and socialist aspects of the UAW Local 600 in Detroit. And so that's why they came to Detroit. She was brought in as the star witness, called the grandmother spy, and she named hundreds of names, and my father's was one of them. So he was, in a sense, collateral damage. But as soon as she testified the same day that subpoena was served on him, the Detroit Times fired him summarily.
Gosh. Your mother was not named, I gather.
No, and, you know, there were three children. She wasn't working at that point, and so maybe they just weren't interested in her. She was in the FBI files, but she was not called before the committee. And so, you know, they went after my father. And that began 5 years of our family sort of bouncing around.
And so where did they go?
My father grew up in Brooklyn. He went to Abraham Lincoln High School in, you know, Coney Island, and we went back there to live with his parents briefly. Then he worked for a newspaper there that folded a month after we got there. Then we moved back to Ann Arbor, where my mother's family lived. We lived with those grandparents briefly. Then he got a job at the Cleveland Plain Dealer because several of his old colleagues at the Michigan Daily, where my father was the editorial editor in the late 30s, that's where he started his newspaper career, they knew about him and hired him. But immediately after he got there, or shortly after, the FBI visited the Cleveland Plain Dealer and told the publisher that, you know, you hired a former communist. And so he was fired. And so then we went back to Detroit. He was out of the newspaper business, blacklisted, worked at a party favor store for a couple of years. Then finally in 1956, there was a strike paper being put out by the International Typographical Union in the Quint Cities of Iowa, Davenport, Bettendorf, Rock Island. And he was hired to be an editor there. That turned out to be the first step of our salvation. It was the paper didn't survive very long, but my father was a really talented all-around newspaper man. He was a great editor, layout, every headlines, writing. And one of the things that strike paper did was it ran a weekly column called Hello, Wisconsin, by the publisher and founder of the Madison Capital Times, an old progressive named William T. Evue, who was one of the La Follette's best buddies. And Evue, because his column was published in this little strike paper in Iowa, he saw it. And he looked at it and said, this is a great little paper. Who's doing this? He heard that it was Elliot Marinus. The paper folded. My dad went up to Madison and got hired on the spot. And this was the summer of 1957. Joseph McCarthy, sort of the central figure of the McCarthy of that era, of the Red Scare, had just died. The Milwaukee Braves were on their way to winning the World Series. We moved a few blocks from the zoo in Madison, and that was our salvation, and life seemed good to me. And it was from then on.
Wow. Now, how do you suppose, or how did you discover, if you did, how your father began to believe in these communist ideas?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I really wanted to figure that out. Why would these two really good, generous, big-hearted people be deceived by the Soviets' murderous and paranoid world for a while? And, you know, the roots of it are idealism. My father's high school, Abraham Lincoln High School, was a very progressive public school where a lot of the teachers were Jewish teachers who, because of quotas, you know, they all had PhDs or master's degrees, and they were pretty progressive people. The principal was a Spinoza scholar who carried around a pocket edition of Emerson's essays in his back pocket, and this was deep in the Depression, so capitalism was on edge. You know, the unemployment rate in Brooklyn was probably 25 or 30%, and so certainly economics had a factor in it, and also for both of my parents, I would say that the deepest motivations of my life, of my parents' life, of my children's lives is racial justice. And I think that seeing, you know, the racism of the United States was also a factor, and seeing that the Communist Party, for, you know, for all of its evils, was standing up for racial justice in the United States. So, you know, at various points in my research, I shake my head, what were you thinking? You know, why? How could you rationalize the Nazi-Soviet pact in 1939? How could you not see what the Stalin's pushes were doing?
Exactly.
And I try to be very honest about it. And it took longer than I would have hoped for them to move on. By the time that HUAC came to Detroit, they were starting to move away from communism.
I see.
You know, I have all of the FBI files. And the only time they were actually able to say that my father belonged to the party was in 1947. 1948, he supported the Henry Wallace campaign, the Progressive Party. He wrote for a left-wing newspaper in Michigan that was connected to the Communist Party after that. And that's part of what he was doing when they came to Detroit. But file after file after 1952, they say, you know, we've talked to everyone. 37 FBI agents were on his case at various times. And there were as many informants. And every time they say, we see no connection between Elliot and Mary Marinus and the Communist Party. They followed him all the way for 5 years saying that until we got to Madison. And then finally in 1958, a year after we were there, they stopped investigating him.
Tell me about the grandmother who was the informant, Berenice. She sounds like a fascinating character.
Yeah, you know, I learned as much as I could about her. Luckily, at the very end, we were able to find her grandchildren. It took a long time because she had been married 3 times. There were a lot of different names to try to search out, and none of them were proving right. And then finally hit upon a granddaughter who lived in suburban Detroit. And when I contacted her, it was one of the most interesting conversations I'd had because she said, you know, none of us knew about what our grandmother was doing. You know, I was very close to her. She never told me about it, kind of like me, you know, and my father. So that's what I said to her. I said, you know, same from my side. And I have a policy of always trying to be completely straightforward with people. So I wasn't going to pretend anything other than what the case was. So immediately I told her, look, my father was called before the committee in 1952. Your grandmother testified, and that's why he was fired. And it was a very rational conversation between us, and she told me she didn't know about it until much later, after her mother had died. She and her brother went into a closet and found all these old clippings about their grandmother. So Berenice Baldwin, you know, a lot of informants were actually members of the Communist Party who'd become disillusioned, or various reasons why they started to name names, feeling guilt about what they'd done or pressured, or a lot of different reasons. She wasn't like that. She was a paid informant. She was doing it for the money.
I was fascinated to read that it was actually her husband who urged her to become an informant.
Yeah, he connected her to the FBI. He's long dead. She divorced him shortly after this. So I couldn't get much information about what his motivation was at all. I only could get to her. You know, in the book I write, I don't hold anything against her. I when I read the transcript of her testifying against my father, it didn't stir up any deep animosity toward me.
What did she say in that testimony?
She testified about a lot of people, and she said that my father worked at the newspaper that was affiliated with the Communist Party, the Michigan Herald, that he never wanted to be called by his name there. They could only call him Ace, which was his nickname, going back to the Michigan Daily and for much later. She had some misinformation about my mother, including a name that I'd never heard before and none of my family had, that she was called Mary Morrison, not Marinus. Maybe it was an alias. I'd never heard it. And she just talked about his presence, and that was enough. You know, she named him, and he was fired that day.
Not that he was spying, not that he was doing something to undermine the federal government, not that he was doing anything on behalf of communism, but rather he went to meetings, and that was about it.
Yeah, you know, that's not to say that there weren't people who were spies for the Soviets and weren't acting on their behalf. But the preponderance of the small number of people who were members of the Communist Party in 1952 were not spies, were not acting in any way except in their speech on behalf of communism and therefore the Soviet Union. So my father, you know, that statement that I found at the National Archives is a very powerful defense of freedom of speech. You know, that the Constitution and the Bill of Rights never thought that you should acquiesce to a conformity of thought, that wasn't part of the American system. And so you have to separate the important part of American democracy and civil liberties is that opinions that are controversial, that are off the norm, that don't conform, that you consider for some reason dangerous, if you're not advocating the overthrow of the American government, they're exactly what needs to be protected. And that's the argument that my father made in his statement, that it was the committee that was undermining American democracy and not him, and that he had a different definition of what it means to be American.
Tell me about your uncle. He was involved as well.
He's really the spark of the story in many ways. My uncle, this is my mother's brother, older brother, Robert Cummins, Bob Cummins, went to the University of Michigan a few years before my dad and was also at the Michigan Daily, actually wrote there with... There's this fascinating connection with Arthur Miller, the great playwright.
Yes.
Who went to Abraham Lincoln High School with my dad a few years before, then went to Michigan, as my father did, was on the Michigan Daily with my uncle. My uncle, you know, coming from a Midwestern family, his father, you know, was born in a lean-to in the hillsides of Kansas, became an engineer, family moved around. They ended up in Ann Arbor largely because of the great education, public education there, and the University of Michigan. So Bob, the oldest of those children, was radicalized at Michigan, probably because of the Depression and a lot of other reasons, and was a member of the Young Communist League there. And he and two of his classmates, Elman Service and Ralph Nefus, the day after school ended in June 1937, went to New York, boarded a ship across to France, took a train across France, and climbed over the Pyrenees Mountains to fight for the Loyalists, the Republicans, against Franco, Hitler, and Mussolini in the Spanish Civil War. Bob and Elman's service survived. Ralph Nefus was captured by Franco's troops and executed in a cathedral in the town of Alcañiz. But Bob and Elman survived. They came back to, the Loyalists lost the war, Franco won, but before it ended, the international troops were called back. And a mistaken belief by the Spanish premier that might stop Hitler and Mussolini from fighting, too. Of course, it didn't. So they came back to the University of Michigan. 400-some students turned out to celebrate their return. Among those were my mother, Bob Cummins's younger sister, 18 years old, and Elliot Marinus, the 21-year-old editorial editor of the Michigan Daily, who was covering that event for the newspaper. And that's where my parents met.
Oh, really?
That day, yes.
And a quick break. When we come back, more from David Marinus. We're back. Here is the rest of my conversation with David Marinus. His new book is titled A Good American Family, The Red Scare and My Father. Going back to the day your father was called before that committee in Detroit, in room 740, there was one of the characters sitting on that committee, John Stevens Wood.
John Stevens Wood was a congressman from Georgia, North Georgia, chairman of the committee. He'd voted against every civil rights bill for decades, voted for the poll tax, had briefly as a young man been a member of the Ku Klux Klan. And stunningly to me, there was a famous lynching in Georgia in 1913, the Leo Frank lynching.
A white man, a Jew.
Yes, came down to Atlanta from the New York area, and he was accused of murdering a 13-year-old woman in his pencil factory. It was a frame-up. He didn't commit it, according to every historian and journalist who's looked at the event. But it became a really big story, not only in Atlanta and in Georgia, but the New York Times came down and covered it for a year, the Chicago Tribune. It was considered one of the central dramas of that era. And eventually, enough evidence came out that the governor felt pressured to commute the death sentence against Leo Frank, which he did. And shortly after that, the powers that be, the men who ran Marietta, Georgia, where the 13-year-old girl was from, concocted a plan to spring Frank from prison, drive him back to a field near Marietta, and lynch him. And the mastermind of that plot was a judge named Newt Morris, sort of the biggest power in Marietta. And Morris's top disciple was John Stevens Wood. And it was actually Wood who drove the car that carried Frank's lynched body to the mortuary after the event. This is the man who called my father un-American. My father who had, we haven't even talked about this, but in World War II, he enlisted and became an officer and a commander of an all-black unit in World War II. And I had, a few hundred letters he wrote home to my mother about that process of training and leading men who had been treated as second-class citizens in a segregated army, and how proud he was of that they considered they were getting a fair shake under him. And to see that contrast of my father being called un-American by John Stevens Wood was pretty striking.
Was he in some way involved in that lynching?
There's a wonderful friend of mine, a great writer named Steve Oney, who wrote a whole book about that. And there's just one little paragraph about Wood in his book, but Steve was very helpful in sending me to the Georgia Historical Society archives and looking at all of the records. And it appears obvious that Judge Morris was the mastermind of the lynching. And the excuse that Wood would later have about it, that they just innocently happened to be there at the site of the lynching, doesn't hold water.
There were, I gather, some in that crowd who wanted to mutilate.
Yes. So that's the point that Wood would make to try to defend himself, that actually Judge Morris stopped the mutilation, which probably is true. I mean, lynching him was enough, or more than enough. So to make themselves look more honorable, a judge, you know, would stand up and say, okay, enough is enough. We've done our job. Don't mutilate him.
What happened to Judge Wood?
Shortly after the Detroit hearings, he retired. And then Eisenhower tried to appoint him to the Subversive Activities Control Board. And that's when the story of Leo Frank and the lynching never came out in any of the hearings, but his involvement in the Klan earlier had, and there was enough controversy about that they withdrew his nomination. There's one other little side note to his life, which is that his second wife was part of one of the biggest families in Georgia, the Jones family. His wife was related to Bobby Jones, the famous golfer. And the wife, at some point after Wood married her, discovered that he was part Indian, Cherokee Indian. And she never slept with him again, according to his daughter and grandson.
Did she divorce him?
She never divorced him, but that was too much for her. So John Stevens Wood, who was defining Americanism to everybody else, was considered not American enough for his own wife.
Tell me how writing this book and really looking into your father's past and recognizing the history that you experienced because of your father's relationship, if I may call it that, with the Communist Party, how do you think that has affected your outlook as a journalist?
It's affected me in a better way. Because he learned the lessons of that. He went through it. He endured it. And by the time I came along, he taught me the lessons, as I said, of not falling for any rigid ideology, searching for the truth, no matter where it is, hating racism but not the racist, trying to be open-minded about human beings. A lot of good lessons came to me from my parents that they had learned because they'd gone through the crucible of being disillusioned by something that they thought they believed in. But the other way it affected me, so many old leftists that I've studied either became neoconservative, staunch anti-communist, devoted to that concept for the rest of their lives, or disillusioned and embittered people. My father was neither of those. He came out of it as a open-minded, liberal optimist. And that's what he infused in me. You know, he used to have a saying that he always would say around whatever was happening, say it could be worse. I never understood what he was really thinking about when he said that until I did this book. But it always sort of infused me with an optimism that we'll get through anything.
Do you see lessons in this book or an ethos that infuses itself to anything happening today?
Absolutely. There are so many echoes. History doesn't repeat itself. In one sense, everything's upside down now. You have conservatives attacking the FBI and the CIA and a president coddling up to a North Korean communist dictator and to the former KGB head. So in that sense, it's all upside down. But you see so many echoes of the use and manipulation of fear as a political weapon, the demonization of certain groups, again, for political purposes, narrow definitions of who's American, what it means to be American, questions about what it means to be patriotic. In a sense, starting with that era in the late 40s, early 50s, the Republican Party saw it as a political tool to call Democrats and liberals soft on communism, soft on everything. And in one way or another, they've been doing it ever since. Someone asked me, well, what would Joe McCarthy think of Donald Trump? Well, they're two peas in a pod. They're both demagogues, both people who really don't have strong ideologies, but would use fear and publicity is a way of making their way in the world and for dangerous purposes. The difference is that Joe McCarthy was a senator and Donald Trump is president, and that's a lot more power. And another difference is that it was actually the Republicans themselves who stood up to Joe McCarthy, Margaret Chase Smith of Maine and a senator from Vermont, and then finally Eisenhower himself, the president. And where's the Margaret Chase Smith today?
David Maraniz, thank you so much.
Thank you, Diane.
Good to be with you. That's all for today. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. You can find all our podcasts and even old Diane Rehm shows at dianereem.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Cliff Gallagher and Natalie Urid-Litker. We'll be back with you again on Friday. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.